I'm here in the studio with Henrietta Mantooth. Welcome, Henrietta.
Thanks, Michelle. I tell you, that song breaks your heart.
It does. It really does. And, you know, I love your work, and I'm really excited that you work to give voice to the nameless, right? Is that correct? You work to give voice to refugees and rebels and farmers and men and women who tend to defend their land, homes, children, animals, and ideas, right?
Yes.
People who are really struggling to do that. And so so I'm here in the studio with Henrietta Mantooth, and she's an artist who's working with the Beyond the Bars art exhibit at GCCA, and it's part of the Slow Justice Project here, where it really working to shed light on the prison industrial complex and the prison system and how it affects marginalized people, how it has really kind of destroyed people's lives. But these are artists and people who are working to, with this art exhibit, it reveals the, and this is from a blurb from GCCA, that it reveals the powerful and transformative role of creative expression in the lives of incarcerated and formerly incarcerated people and their advocates. And through art, writing, performance, and filmmaking, I'm looking at how those things can actually alter the trajectory of one's life to process the anguish, fear, anger, and hopefully change things for future generations. And so you're part of this project, which I think is really, really wonderful, Henrietta. So thank you for the work that you have done as a part of this project and your art exhibit. So thank you for that.
Good. I hope you'll go.
I plan to go. Yes, yes, I plan to go. You know, we've got these interviews going on over a period of weeks. And so you're this week. Jalal is next week, and he's going to be talking about his farm project. And Cedric is in October, and there are some interviews kind of spread out in between there, but I wanted to do interviews over the life of this because it starts in September but runs through November.
Yes.
And so I want to make sure that people, that we stay in people's minds throughout, you know, the time that the exhibits will be up and showing, so that people don't forget, which is why I wanted to spread the interviews out instead of having them, you know, doing them all at the beginning. And there's an opening reception. That opening reception is Saturday, September 26, 2015, from 5 to 7 p.m. at the GCCA Catskill Gallery.
Right.
So, Prison Industrial Complex, your exhibit is titled The New Jim Crow. Was that correct?
It's a titled Jailbirds.
Jailbirds,
and
right,
the
right.
New Jim Crow.
Jailbirds and the New Jim, that's right, and I knew that.
Right.
Jailbirds and the New Jim Crow. And so The New Jim Crow, for those of you who don't know, is a book by Michelle Alexander. It was part of the reading I did while I was in Divinity School. While I was at Yale Divinity School, I had the opportunity to hear Michelle Alexander speak about her book, The New Jim Crow. And Yale Divinity School actually provided copies of the book for every single student and staff member at Yale Divinity School that wanted a copy. They provided them. So all you had to do was show up and get your copy of the book and sign off on it, because it's really important that people know what the problems are in the system. And so you work to point this out in your work.
Yes. You know, I chose to use birds. When I first thought of this show, I call it Jailbirds, because I use birds. People ask me, why do you use birds? And some people told me, because birds are messengers. So I said, okay, I'll use the birds, and I won't put human figures in it. And it's something I want to attract people. I thought the birds and the colorfulness of it would attract people, rather than making a judgment or preaching to them. It would draw them in. Some beauty would draw them in.
Right, and they are beautiful, and you use different colors of birds. You use a lot of different colors of birds.
I do, and then I get to the black. Then always crows have been a favorite of mine. Once, unfortunately, one flew in front of my car years ago. I don't know if it survived, but I always remember right. that crow. So maybe it's sending me a message now.
Yeah, maybe it is sending you a message now. And, you know, I think it's really interesting that you do use black, but for me, not, you know, highly. When I look at the populations of blacks that are incarcerated, you know, blacks in this country are make up more than 60% of the 2.1 million inmates that are incarcerated in this country. And when you look at the fact that blacks just don't make up the majority of the population, it, for me, it calls into question what's going on, like what is really going on in the system. And so, and I shared with you just before we started the interview that I was a law enforcement officer. I was a federal law enforcement officer. I worked in national parks across the country. Sometimes I was out in the middle of nowhere because the parks I worked in were really rural. And in other areas, I worked in cities because they were national park sites administered by the National Park Service that were in the middle of a city area. And you asked me an interesting question. You want to
ask you again?
Yes.
Did you arrest some white people?
She asked me, did I arrest some white people? I arrested a lot of white people. I actually arrested more white people than I've arrested
Good
black
for
people.
You.
Oh my gosh. But I'll tell you how the system works. Okay. The system generally works against people who can't afford good legal representation. And so what I saw time and again, I'll never forget, there was a white female that I had arrested for drunk driving. And there were a whole host of other things that were not right that, you know, I also gave charges to her for that day. And, you know, we're in the office because often what happened is deals were worked before you ever got to the courtroom. And so I'm in the office with our assistant United States attorney, and I'm not sure if her attorney was there or not, but our AUSA said, he was like, well, you know, she's never really been in any trouble before. And, you know, how about if we reduce the charges from drunk driving to this? And I was like, well, like, she was drunk driving. Like, why are we going to reduce the charges if she was drunk driving? And we ended up, and I was totally against it, but we ended up reducing the charges and letting all of the other citations that she was written for stick. And so when I look at how laws are unequally applied, you know, and how the system is unequally applied, I can't tell you the number of calls that I got for, like, suspicious black people, where there were people who were minding their own business. Like, there were just, you know, when I was in Ohio, one day my supervisor came in and she had passed this area that morning, and she was like, oh, you know, you need to go check on this person. I think they're trying to break into this car. It was a Jaguar, black male Jaguar. He'd gone in to eat his breakfast in just, like, a nice area. It was his car, you know, so I still had to, like, drive through the area. And I was just like, oh, really? But that kind of thing happened all the time. And it didn't, like, preclude me from, like, not stopping, thinking that this person was probably being profiled, or they were being profiled by whomever made the call. And, you know, so I think it's really important that people know, like, I arrested far more white people than I did black people. But when I look at the people who are in jail, once I realized the system was so imbalanced from being in the system and being a part of the system in a way that made me the oppressor, for lack of a better term, you know, I shared that with some people the other week. I did a talk on race. And I said, you know, for a period of time, I was the oppressor. Like, I represented that for people. It didn't matter that I didn't see myself in that way. You know, I still represented that. And once I saw how imbalanced the system was, I recognized that there was a need for change. And I'm just really glad that others are recognizing that, too. And so tell me why I think there's need for change. But tell me why you think there's need for change.
That there's room for change?
Yes.
Well, you know, I'm old. I was born in Kansas City, Missouri, 90 years ago. And
what?
Yes. And I've seen a lot of changes. People don't realize how many changes have happened. I lived in a segregated city. It was a lower middle class. My The people around me were white, and the janitors in the building were black, and they lived there with their families, and they invited me for dinner as a kid, and I enjoyed that family life down in the basements of the building. But I never went to school with blacks, even people who were swarthy, and I couldn't go in a restaurant with a black. And when I went to college, I studied as a journalist in Columbia, Missouri, School of Journalism, and it was all white, and we met with some black students from the other university, and we met socially with them, and we were warned that we would be expelled if that continued because it was against Missouri state law.
Now, so what'd you do?
We continued to meet, but we didn't get expelled, but we felt endangered. We
right.
were warned
right.
that we would be. And so anyway, I've seen a lot of changes, and what makes me really feel happy now is all the publicity that's coming out, all the news, all the stories in various magazines, in the and newspapers. I just am so glad it's coming out. I know how easy it is to be arrested if you're black or Latino.
Right. Yeah. And it's really easy. You know, because what happens
you
is
just have to be driving.
You can just be driving, and I'll never forget. I was stopped one night. I was back home. I'm from the Outer Banks of North Carolina. And it was late. It was about 11 o'clock at night. And this is before I was a law enforcement officer. And I was driving my car, and I had a ball cap on. I look like a man, right? Ball cap on at night. You can't really tell who's in the car. And I get stopped. The officer comes up to the window. He had no reason to stop me. And he says to me, oh, well, I was like, why'd you stop me? He was like, well, you drove across the center line. And I said, no, I didn't. And I said it so fast.
That's a danger to say that.
It is. It is a danger. And I said, no, I didn't. I said, well, if anything, I was dancing to the music in the car.
Oh.
But I didn't break the center line. And he said, oh, well, and he wanted to know where I was going. I was like, well, I'm going home. You know, this is where I live. I'm going to my mom and dad's house. And he was like, license, registration, proof of insurance. He asked for all this stuff, right? I didn't even have it in the car. I think I had my driver's license somewhere, and people who've ridden with me will tell you I'm the person who's got like the seat full of stuff, like the front seat full of stuff that I have to like clean everything out before you can get into my car. And so he's looking at my car, and he was just like, I was like, I don't know. It's all probably in here somewhere. Like, we can take a look for it if we need to. You know, it's 11 o'clock by the side of the road.
You were lucky, Michelle.
I really was. But you know what? I think because I was a woman, I think because I was a female, and he was just like, all right, miss, have a good night. I was like, thanks. But I know that that doesn't happen. I know it doesn't happen. I know it's really rare. And I think that women sometimes do get a little more leeway, especially if you look a certain way.
Yeah.
If you behave a certain way.
Yeah.
And that's what's really disappointing, because we know that people are treated differently based on how they look. Like, that's what we know. We see it all the time in our society, and we see it with these police stops.
Right.
And I think that this has always gone on. Having been a law enforcement officer, I can say I know that this has always gone on, people being mistreated by police. But I think we see it now because everybody has a video camera. With the advent of smartphones, right? Most people now have video cameras. And so before, where if you were going to have a video camera, you had to be like right up on the person, you know, like,
yes.
you $1,500, $2,500 video camera. But now everybody's got a video camera that costs like $99, you know, dollars or less, depending on who your cell phone service provider is and what kind of phone you have. And I think that's why it's finally coming out into the media. That's why people are finally seeing what's really taking place.
It seems to be that, well, more blacks and Latinos are arrested, mm-hmm. and more blacks and Latinos are beaten up in jail.
Right.
And I want to know, where does the permission come? Where does it come from, the permission to beat up inmates?
Permission comes from the system.
But that system, there are people and that's doing that.
They are. And that's why I was at a protest. I've been to protests now. That's what I've been doing, is going to protests. And I, you know, get all suited up in my clergy gear and go, because I know that the system gives you permission to do this. There was a man that I had arrested. And during, so when we took our prisoners to the U.S. Marshals Service for holding, because they were federal. And so he complained about all these ailments and things. Once we got him to the Marshals Service, they made me take him to the hospital to get him medically cleared before they put him in with other inmates. And while we were at the hospital, he bit me. Okay. He bit me, but because he'd spit his teeth at me earlier. And so I had actually kept his teeth and put him in an evidence bag. And so thankfully I did, because when he clamped down on my arm, he like held onto my arm. And if he'd had his teeth in, he had full blown AIDS, which is why we ended up having to take him to the hospital and all this other stuff. So, you know, my life could possibly be very different right now because of all of those things. And so when I was talking to our AUSA about how to charge him, right, she says to me, and I quote, "Why didn't you just beat the out of him?"
Yeah.
I was like, I looked at her and I was like, "Excuse me?" She was like, "Well, that would have been easier than, you know, like bringing him here and having him go through the system. You should have just beat him up."
See?
And so these are the things that are happening, right, that people are not aware are happening. And so I was like, but that's not who I am. You know, that's not who I am. That's not how I was raised. I was raised to treat everyone fairly, to treat people decently the way that you would want to be treated. But that was her response. And so I can guarantee you that those are the responses that officers get across the country from the people that have to deal with their cases.
So guards and officers, they have to be trained in a different way.
They really should be trained in a different way. And the thing is, now I wasn't trained that way. I can tell you that I was trained at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center, and the way they trained us was to do everything by the book, so that if something happened, you would be able to take care of yourself, to cover yourself. But being trained and then what actually happens when you're out there are two totally different things, because the system has been allowed to run amok for such a long time without real oversight, that you do have, you know, these people who are in positions of power saying things to officers like, "Well, you should have just beat him up, and that would have made less work for me." And that's essentially what she said to me that day.
You know, I asked this ex-inmate, Andre Noel, who's a dancer that I've done a little work with. He learned to do modern dance in prison from a volunteer. I said, and he went to about four of the biggest prisons. He was in there 15 years. Mm-hmm. But I asked, 12 years. He went in when he was 15. I asked him if he ever got beaten up in prison. He said, no. Oh. And I said, how come? He said, because I became an Uncle Tom. And then we talked about being an Uncle Tom, and we realized that at certain situations, we all become Uncle Toms.
What did he mean by that when he said that?
He means that he said, yes, sir, yes, ma'am, of course, thank you. He demeaned himself. He didn't mean the other meaning, that he was against his own people.
Okay.
He turned in his own people. He just meant his own demeanor. Like this woman who was arrested, and I forget her name now, but she supposedly hanged herself in prison.
Yeah, that's really right. Hard and difficult, and
right.
I just can't believe that.
I can't believe
it
either.
What happened? I can't believe that that's what took place.
And she never should have been arrested. But she, if I don't know if it would have been any better if she had said, okay, I'll put out my cigarette. Okay, I'll do it. But then what about these kids?
It would have been better, but it doesn't make it right.
That's right.
Right?
It doesn't make it certain.
Especially if that officer had already decided he wasn't going to cite her. Because he had already, I think, if I'm remembering the stories of that case correctly, with Sandra Bland, he had already decided he wasn't going to cite her. You know, but then he was like, well, put out your cigarette. And it's like, well, if you're not going to write her a ticket, if you've already decided to let her go, essentially, why aren't you going to let her go? Except that he got mad that she, like, didn't, quote unquote, respect his authority when he, you know, when he was giving her commands. And that is just, she shouldn't have been in jail. And, you know, let's say she did commit suicide, right? Let's say that the possibility is very real that she may have committed suicide. I say the blood is still on their hands because yes, she shouldn't have been in jail in the first place.
Right.
You know, you're taking someone who, you know, I mean, she was self-diagnosed mental illness, you know, but potentially someone who maybe was mentally ill. Now you've mistreated them. Now you've put them in jail. They see no end in sight. And so the possibility exists that maybe she did commit suicide. But if she did, it was definitely her situation was exacerbated by the way she was treated by that officer in the system.
You know, I saw this on television recently. Again, I'd seen it before. These young people being arrested in a park. And this officer had thrown this young girl down. I mean, she must have been maybe 14, 15.
Right, at the pool party.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Pool party. And he, you know, grabbed her hair. I mean, how can that happen?
Right. It shouldn't happen. It's not supposed to happen. And I can definitely say that that's not how I was trained when I was doing law enforcement work. But being out doing the work, I saw that was often how people were treated. There was a guy that we had arrested one day, and he wasn't on federal property, so we basically were detaining him until the city officer showed up. And it was myself and another female officer. And, you know, a city officer shows up, it's a man, and we get the guy out of our patrol car, turn him over to him, and the guy's, you know, he's cussing us out, calling us all sorts of names, but we were trained to not react to that. And next thing I know, the city officer hauls off and hits the guy so hard, he falls. And my partner was able to just get her hand under his head before it hit the concrete. So we get this guy up, get him in the city officer's patrol car. After we shut the door, I look at the city officer and I say, "Hey, man, I don't know like where you were taught to do that, but that's not what we do here."
Yes.
You know, like, that's not how we do law enforcement here. And he got mad. He got upset and never showed up again for backup for us in that area. And so I knew that by, like, reprimanding officers and reporting them, it did put me at a certain amount of risk. But it didn't stop me from doing it.
Yes. You know, there are a couple of questions I want. For instance, I read this phrase, the violence of poverty.
Yeah.
I mean, These kids who are put in jail, they weren't born that way.
Right.
No, and there is a violence in poverty. I remember when I was a kid riding on the streetcar through what we call the Negro District. Mm-hmm. And kids know everything. I mean, I knew that was not right. I knew something was wrong. Another phrase, the violence of segregation.
Right.
What's that like for you? What's it like to be segregated?
Well, you know, I'm from the South, and I actually prefer the South in a lot of ways to the North, because at least down South, people are honest about who they are and about where they are with regards to race, which I found is not necessarily the case up here. And both my parents grew up in segregation, you know, so both my parents went to segregated schools growing up. And
but how does that feel? What does that do to you?
Well, I can tell you how it feels to be mistreated because of my race.
Right.
You know, it definitely feels, it's disconcerting, especially, you know, because what I've found is that these things manifest, like race, especially in the North, manifests itself in really different ways. So I was telling this talk that I gave on race and privilege last week, I was, you know, shared with this group of people. That here in Hudson, I walked into a shop one day. At the time, it was one of my favorite little places to go to get something to drink and, I don't know, a piece of cake or something. Something I didn't need, but that I wanted, right? And so they help the person who's in line in front of me. And then when I get to the counter, they just walk away to go do something else in the store. And they're carrying on a conversation. And so I stand there and I stand there and I stand there. And so now I've got to make the decision. Well, do I leave, right? Or do I go say something? And so I was raised to say something. And so I go over to the woman and I was like, so
what town was this?
Here. It was here in Hudson. And so I say to the woman, I said, so I was waiting to be helped. And she said, oh, I didn't even see you.
Yes, it's true. She doesn't really see you.
Yeah, and it is. And she didn't. I mean, she didn't want to see me, right?
Right.
And so that, it really, because I know that I'm better than that, but it still doesn't keep from making me angry. And, you know, my parents raised us because both of them did grow up in segregation. You know, they taught us from a very young age, like, you're going to have to be 10 times better than this person over here, because you will be mistreated because of your race. And, you know, when I was younger, I didn't understand that, but it's I've seen it and experienced it to be true. And that for me is the thing that's most disappointing. You know, my dad tells a story about my dad was career Army, but there was a period of time when he had enlisted, served his time, and then got out of the military. And because he decided, you know, like, I don't know that I need to be, like, fighting for my country and still being mistreated because I'm black. And he'd applied for a job with DuPont, okay? And they looked at his resume, offered him the job without ever seeing him. They interviewed him over the phone.
Oh, God.
And when he showed up for his first day of work, they said, we didn't hire you. Right. He said, I have the letter right here saying that you've hired me. They're like, nope, we didn't hire you. And I mean, he packed up and moved to a different state. And then this is what they said. And so growing up, hearing their stories and then experiencing what it was like to live in a society where I've been raced almost my entire life. You know, I mean, there's the kid who wore the KKK t-shirt to school when I was in high school, who walked around with it all day. It had a Klansman and a burning cross on it. And, you know, if we as black kids wore Malcolm X t-shirts to school, they made us turn them inside out.
Right.
Right. Or they sent us home.
So what do you live in the segregated life? Do you have are your best friends black?
My best friends are a combination of my two best friends. One is white, one is black. I've got, you know, kind of a mixed group of friends. I'm in what they call a cross-racial appointment in the United Methodist Church. So I pastor a church that's predominantly white. But I have lived in all black communities. The undergraduate institution that I went to was all black. I went to a historically black university. But then, you know, I've gone on to, I did master's work at Yale. And so I've got a cross-cultural group of friends, but I know that's not the case for everyone. Most people live really segregated lives.
You know, I mean, I'm interested in this whole situation of black to white, and yet my life is segregated in a way. Of course, I have black friends, quite a few, but I see my life as living with whites. You know what? I'm tired of whites.
Really?
Yes.
What makes you say that?
Because I feel like from the time I was a kid, I felt the warmth of black people. It's a different family warmth.
Right.
And then I lived many years in Latin America.
Right. 18 years, right?
Yeah. So I got to feel, I got to a point in Venezuela that I didn't even know who was black and white. Someone say, oh, you notice? Oh, no, I didn't know. It would be great if we didn't know who's black and white. We see color. I know your sweater's pink.
Right.
But it doesn't change my feeling about you.
Right. And I think it's important that you say that, you know, because we do see, you know, when I was with this group of people last week, there were some people who were like, no, you know, I don't. And I was like, no. Like, when we meet a person, before that person speaks, we notice the outer, right? We notice what that person has on. We notice their hair. We notice facial features. We notice skin color. I mean, it's programmed in us to notice these things. Like, it's not anything we can get away from. But what we can be aware of is how we treat people, right, in that moment when we meet them, right? How we treat people, how we respond to people. And that to me is the most important thing, is being mindful. Okay, well, yes, stereotypes and biases are real. You know, like, yes, I was enculturated in a certain way growing up as a black person, primarily in the South, right? But because I grew up in this certain way doesn't mean it necessarily has to define how I treat people, right? And how I treat all people. And I think that that's what's missing with these police interactions.
Yes.
Right? Is because police are being taught, well, you know, if a person is this race and they're driving a really, really, really nice right. car, they probably got the car because it's stolen or because yeah. they're a drug dealer. I've heard those things being both said and taught.
Yeah, I have too. Do you feel more comfortable with blacks and or whites, or does it depend on the person?
Oh, Henrietta, it depends on the person, I would say. It depends on the person. It depends on the situation.
You know, I had a situation. When my mother died, and my white people were saying, oh, it's for the best, and you'll get used to it, and so forth. But I had a friend who was black who lived with us, and so she invited all her black friends. And, you know, they really talked about, oh, I know about my mother, and they had an emotion, what I mean to say. Right. I think black people, and maybe this is a generalization, black people and Latinos have more sense of family and humanity.
Well, I would definitely say we're enculturated in a different way, right? And my experience of it has been that you'll see that same sense of family with European immigrants and with people of color, uh-huh. right? Because you still have the family as a system, right. family as a unit. I don't know. I know lots of young African Americans my age who lived in extended households. You know, my grandmother lived with us up until she passed away. You know, who lived, you know, with that extended family unit with, you know, maybe grandparents were in the house instead of placing someone in a nursing facility. Maybe they stayed with the family and the family cared for them. Part of that is, I think, because of respect for elders, but part of it may in part be due to socioeconomics as well.
Right.
You know, like we're not going to spend the money putting someone in a nursing facility when we could take care of them at home right. and all of us, you know, pick up some of the slack. Whereas, and I've seen that also from immigrant families as well, whether they are regardless of where they're coming from. But it's not something that I've seen with my white friends.
You know, I was reading a book about adolescents who are arrested. This one mm-hmm. boy, 14 years old, was in prison. He was involved with a gang murder. He was given life in prison.
Right.
He said, the gangs were my family.
Mm-hmm.
The street was my home.
Right. You know, and so often when you look at, you asked the question earlier about violence and poverty, you know, prior to me working in downtown Atlanta, I kind of had this idea and this mentality, well, you know, like, why can't people do better? Right? Because we're all given the same opportunities.
No.
And we're not all given
no,
the same.
No, we're not.
We're not all given the same opportunities.
From the time you're born, you're not.
Say. We're not all given the same opportunities. We don't, you know, and the thing that really changed it for me was there was a woman one day who had these two little children with her, two small kids, a little girl who was maybe 7 or 8 years old, and a little boy who was just walking. And, you know, like they'd asked her for candy or something, just walking, just talking, but they were young kids. And I'd watched them as they'd walked up the street to, there was a Catholic church that fed anybody who needed a meal on Tuesdays and Thursdays. So they'd gone up there to get a meal. They lived in this low-income housing development that was just adjacent to the property, the park where I was working. And so I saw them as they walked up and they're coming back. You know, the kid have asked her for candy. And I watched as she cussed these kids out. Now, she didn't see me, called them all sorts of stupid MFs and you name it. OK,
it's a white person.
No, African-American woman and her two. I think they were her two children. And I was just like, oh. And so the little girl sees me. Right. She sees me, law enforcement officer, and she's pulling on the woman's dress, trying to get her to stop. Right. Trying to get her attention. And she's like, stop pulling on me, you blankety blank, blank, blank. And I was just like, oh, my gosh. So I call her. I was like, you know, I call her over. I was like, hey, ma'am, let me talk to you for a second. And I pull her away from the kids because I always, if I had to reprimand an adult, I always tried to do it like away from their children. Right. Because there's still a yep. certain amount of like respect that you want to kind of try to maintain even within that. And so I pull her away from the kids. And at the time I was like, I don't know, I think I was like 24, 25. And I say to her, and I'm just like, ma'am, I heard the kids ask you for candy, and I saw your response, right? You can't afford the candy from the store. If I have to give you a ticket for your bad behavior today, it just makes your situation that much worse. You know, and so she understood that what she was doing wasn't the right way to like reprimand her children and to treat them. I don't know if it changed it or not, you know, but when I saw that day, I said, man, if that's all you know from the time that you're old enough to talk, right, until the time that you, you know, get to be 18 or 19, and then you encounter the law enforcement officer who only then demeans you even further, right? And, you know, the first thing they want to do is lock you up when you've done something, you know, and it's like, it creates a no-win situation, especially, you know, for young people. There was a young man that I had arrested one day. He was smart. He was industrious. He was selling, he had mashed up peanuts so that they look like pieces of crack. And he was selling these mashed up peanuts to druggies on the street instead of selling them drugs. And so I pick him up, and you get the same amount of time for selling fake drugs as you do for selling real drugs. I don't know if you know that or not.
I don't.
You generally do, though, get the same amount of time. And so he's crying and carrying on. He was, like, just old enough to have a job. And, you know, I took him to his mom. I took him home and had a long talk with his mom. I actually took him to his mom's job that day instead of arresting him. Because we had field test kits, and I could test it, and it wasn't drugs. But, you know, and just... he later found me, and so did she, and they wanted to just say thank you for like giving him the second opportunity, you know, because law enforcement officers have that ability, you know, to give people a second chance, you know, because I catch you selling drugs and maybe you're 14 doesn't mean that I have to take you to jail. It doesn't,
right.
You know? And so when I look at how the laws are enforced, it's almost like there's, the officer has forgotten not only this other person's humanity, but they've forgotten their own humanity in the process. Which what I really love about your art exhibit is that it pulls humanity out of the picture so that we have to focus on nature, right?
Oh, really?
Yeah, it pulls humanity out so that we have to focus on nature. And so now we're looking at these birds, these beautiful creatures, right, that we all can identify with. Behind bars,
you see, right? The bars. I want people just to see the bars and feel the bars and know what it's like to be behind bars. Mm-hmm. And of course, everybody. I remember going in to visit I had a half brother who spent some time in jail, prison, and I remember the sound of the. Everybody remembers the sound of those gates. But imagine living, like one man. 34 years in solitary confinement,
right.
Because he wouldn't confess to a murder, which it was eventually found he didn't do.
Right, yeah, yeah.
So there's so many stages. I mean, there's the justice system, and poor people are getting fines that they cannot pay.
Right.
And then, and for small, I don't know, maybe your taillight's broken or something.
Mm-hmm.
So they get a fine they can't pay, and then because of that they get another fine, and then they get another. You know, this is revenue for these
towns. And the thing is, and they do it on purpose because they could also, I mean, they could also give the person a warning, right, with something,
right.
which are things that I've done that I did before as an officer. You give the person a warning, you give them 3 days or a week to get their taillight fixed if it's a taillight out, if that's why you've really stopped them. And, you know, if they don't get it fixed in 3 days or a week or whatever, then you go forth with, like, whatever charges you were going to put on
them. And then the terrible thing is when people get out of prison.
They can't get work.
They can't get a place to live. They can't get it. Yeah. So then they're back in and they're back in and they're back in.
Yep. I can't tell you the number of homeless people that I worked with when I was in Atlanta. People that I would pick up who, you know, had these really long records, some of them. And I'd just be like, you know what? Like, you've got life. Your life is hard enough without me writing you, you know, another ticket or taking you to jail today for what you did. And oftentimes, I often gave lectures. You can tell. I often gave lectures, Henrietta, and was just like, do better. You know, like, don't let me catch you out here again. Do better. Like, consider this, like, your break today for, like, you know, to give yourself the opportunity.
Because your anger didn't get to the point of those guards in the jails.
No.
You see, they're angry about a lot of things.
They're angry about a lot of things.
And so they take it out on whoever's there.
Angry about a lot of things. They don't treat people well. Henrietta, let's tell people where and how they can see and experience your art.
In Catskill at the gallery. I never can deal with initials, but it's what the name is.
Oh, the GCCA.
Yes. It's a gallery. It's an installation. It's on Main Street. I use materials. I like to use the most ordinary materials like cardboard, corrugated cardboard, brown paper, boxes, and I feel closer to those kind of materials rather than real fine ones. And what I want to do as an artist is to give the idea that the people behind these bars are real. I don't think that we know that. Someone has to say, these are real human beings who are going through these years behind bars and without hope. And I want even the good-hearted don't realize what's happening behind bars and how they got that way.
Right, right. And you bring up a really important point, is that people really don't realize what's going on. And I think it's important that we let people know and that you're doing this through your art. So thank you so much. And thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks, Michelle. I love being here.
Yeah, well, thank you, Henrietta. And you'll definitely want to check out her art. It is beautiful and fantastic and will really, really make you think.
Yes, I think you should come. You'll like it.
Oh, I plan to come. I'll be there. I'll be there. So thank you so much for being here with me in the studio today, Henrietta.
Thanks.
So I want to remind you about the barbecue that's coming up at Catskill United Methodist Church. It is this Saturday. It's tomorrow from 4 to 7 p.m.